11, 10, 9, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Hey folks, it is Monday, May 4th, 2015, and you're listening to episode 13 of the Beyond the Handle podcast. I'm your host, Alan, also known as @Slip on Twitter. That's Slip with five I's, or Slip. On today's show, I'm very excited to have TJ Mon, also known on Twitter as @TJ_Mon. That's M-A-U-G-H-A-N. TJ is a former blogger, writer, editor at Arctic Ice Hockey, and is an avid sports fan. Winnipeg Jets, Cleveland Browns, Cleveland Indians, Washington Capitals. And I guess I should have put the Capitals at the start of that list because I believe that's the team that he is the most into. So we get into how he becomes a fan of all of these teams that are outside of Winnipeg. And also, of very special interest to me, TJ went to the same high school that I did, and we also lived on the same street, though at the same time only for a very brief period of time. I was on the street for a number of years. He moved in, and very shortly after that, I moved out. Not specifically because he moved in, though. It was just, you know, a coincidence. We didn't know each other until we met on Twitter. So anyways, it's a really good conversation, and I hope that you enjoy it. Last week's episode with Louise Valcourt at Enchanted Parlor was really well received once again. If you haven't had a chance to hear it, Lou did a tarot reading for me as well as for the Winnipeg Jets, and I think that it's something that you should definitely check out, and I can already tell you that her reading for me, there has been some developments over the last week for me that are in line with what she has told me. So there you go. So go and check that out and stick around now because we're going to get into the interview. This is TJ Mon. Again, that's @TJ_MAUGHAN here on Beyond the Handle. All right, everybody, this is episode 13 of Beyond the Handle, and I've got another great guest in the studio with me. I'd like to welcome TJ Mon, or Trevor Mon. We'll go by TJ.
TJ is totally fine.
TJ is totally fine, so welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me to your wonderful abode here. It's quite nice in the Batcave.
I call it the studio, but you know, it's just a dude's apartment, but... So welcome aboard to the show. The first question I ask people when they come onto the show, and I think the answer is pretty obvious with you, is, the story behind the handle.
Well, for sure. When I got on Twitter, I guess the year was probably, 2009, 2010, somewhere in there. I was just kind of figuring out what it was all about. The tool that it is now for me wasn't really what I was using it for back then. I was just making, off-color jokes and this kind of stuff. Whatever I could fit into 140 characters. It wasn't really centered in one thing. My handle used to be TJ Caps, because I'm a big Washington Capitals fan, and I figured it was short and cute and all that kind of stuff. But, around 2011, I got a great opportunity, to write about sports, through SB Nation. With the Arctic Ice Hockey site. And after a couple months of doing that and then, getting a managing editor role there.
Yeah.
I figured, I might as well put my name behind what I'm writing. You know, I was taking pot shots at people and all that kind of stuff. So I'm like, well, listen, I should at least have a name out there so that, you know, if anybody wants to call me out, they have that opportunity. So yeah, it's basically, my initials, T for Trevor, J for James, and then an underscore and Mon, because apparently there's a ton of TJ Mons out there.
So, are there?
Yeah, there was, it's trying to give me like TJ Mon 71. I'm like, nah, I'm not really feeling that. So yeah.
So a Caps fan.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. What year did this start?
The story kind of goes like this. Growing up, I was a pretty big Jets fan, back in like the CKND days when, the games would be on TV. that was basically all I had. I grew up in Ildishane, Manitoba, okay. which is kind of suburbia, I guess, for your listeners that don't know. It's about 15 minutes south of the city off the 59 highway. So basically, you take the 59 right in, it becomes Lage, and then you're into Transcona area. So it's just outside. So it was a lot of jet stuff. And obviously, Jets leave in 1996. I don't really have a team. Hockey's not really on. Listening to the Coyotes every once in a while. Kirk Kielback on the radio. But the spring of 1998, the Capitals went on a big playoff push. They made the Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah.
Where they got swept by the Detroit Red Wings. I was always a big Joey Juneau fan growing up. I used to be a big hockey card collector.
Okay.
And there was one particular card that I had from him. It was an Upper Deck card. And it was like the motion of a slap shot. So it's like him in three different stills on this card. And it's like skating up, winding up, and then the follow through. And I always thought it was a super cool card. So he kind of became a favorite player of mine. And he was on that team. Phil Housley was on that team, former Winnipeg Jet. Mike Eagles, former Winnipeg Jet. I liked Oli Kolzig's goalie mask, so it all kind of came together, and they were a fun team to follow.
Bondra on that team at the time?
Yeah, Bondra was also on that team. Yeah, and he was arguably their best player. Juneau probably a close second. I'm trying not to be biased about it, but so then from there, my hockey fandom kind of waned into the early 2000s. It was tough to get your hands on content at the time, especially locally, outside of like your Saturday night hockey night in Canada kind of thing. So,
yeah.
Kind of took a dip there. And then when, they drafted Ovechkin, everything kind of came back full force, and they were fun. They were fresh. They were young, and, just been really hooked ever since. So.
So when they drafted Ovechkin, then there was a lockout. Did you like, everybody knew Ovechkin was a massive, massive prospect. So were you a fan at the time of the drafting and spending a year anticipating, or was it kind of when it started with his first season?
I was all in. Like, I've always followed the World Juniors really closely, because growing up, it was a tournament that was always right around Christmas. It was during that 2 weeks that you always had Christmas vacation from school. So whether it was in Malmo or Canada or anywhere in the world, you could basically watch it at a young age because you had nothing going on. And, so in 2003, I believe it was in Halifax, and that was the first taste that I kind of got of Ovechkin, and just a dynamic hockey player. I believe Ilya Kovalchuk was on that team as well, mm-hmm. and they were both just freaks. Ended up winning the gold, and I'm like, hey, I like, this kid's fun to watch. Like, he's physical, he's talented, like, he's everything that I've been taught is a great prototypical hockey player. So they draft, Washington gets the first overall pick in 2004, they draft him. And the 2005 World Juniors happened to be in Thief River Falls.
Yeah.
So, my dad, who is on the board for Hockey Manitoba, was able to wrangle us up some tickets. So him and I went down, and we ended up watching, Russia play Belarus. So we got to see Ovechkin, Malkin, other guys that I'm kind of blanking on right now, but just watching Ovechkin out there, like in a world of his own with Malkin, from that point I was hooked.
And that tournament, for those that don't remember, that was during the NHL lockout, so most World Juniors, the most talented players of that age are probably in the NHL, but for that 1 year, the players were not in the NHL, so they played in the World Juniors, which far and away benefited Canada.
That's a great way of putting it, because that year they were basically looked as a dream team, right? Like, they had Patrice Bergeron, who probably wouldn't have been there, Mike Richards and Jeff Carter, who probably wouldn't have been there, Perry and Getzlaff, Crosby, like their top six is an Olympic team.
Weber
right
was
now.
One of the defensemen.
Yeah, Weber was there. Phaneuf was
Andrew
there.
Ladd was there.
Yes, he was.
He was.
And then like you had like Steven Dixon and Danny Savret that were kind of like thrown in there as like these one-off guys that just coming around. And if anybody gets hurt, you know, you'll feel
imagine
them, but
you're the guy on that team who didn't become like a big NHL star.
Well, and it's funny too, because at the time, I've always been a big, and not to kind of go off on a different tangent here, but I've always been a big, Brandon Wheat Kings fan, being kind of local, and Eric Fair was kind of coming up during that time as well. And I still remember the last cut on that team, oddly enough, was between Eric Fair and Corey Perry. And it's funny how those two careers have kind of gone in different, directions since. Fair can't seem to stay healthy with the shoulder problems and all that, but now Corey Perry's a prototypical star and, former MVP, currently leading his team in scoring in the NHL playoffs. I mean, it's crazy to think that he was almost cut from a World Junior team.
Yeah. Kind of thing. And so you must be pretty happy right now, hockey-wise, because you have the Wheat Kings, who are, I believe they're still up 2-1 in their series with the Hitmen.
They're actually up 3-1.
3-1?
They won last night. Game 5 goes tonight in Brandon. Okay. So,
and then you have the Washington Capitals, who won with, what, a second left yesterday?
Yeah, they did. It's funny. I was I had the game recording because I was watching the NFL draft. My friends and I that are kind of in a fantasy football league together always kind of try to get together for NFL draft. Canton weekend, that's the first preseason game, and the U.S. Thanksgiving games. Yeah. So I always try to block that off. So it just so happened that Washington was playing the same night, and I got home. I sprinted home after I'd watched the draft and kind of watched it on fast forward. And originally I didn't see the goal because, you know, there's 3 seconds left. There's a face off. I'm like, I'll just fast forward, get to overtime. And then, you know, I see Joel Ward getting hugged on the bench and I'm like, hey, something happened. I have to rewind. And yeah, oddly enough, they scored with 1.6 seconds left.
So and so great. You were clearly off of Twitter at that time. And I guess now I know because right before the, right before Cleveland was going to make their pick, I tweeted that you must be very nervous, and then didn't hear back. So now I can know why you weren't on Twitter.
Yeah,
we spoiled the game.
Well, and it was kind of the thing too. We were a bit behind on watching the draft. We started it around 8, so I just kind of went on full shutdown mode because no matter what you tell your friends, like I have a group of friends that we all have kind of a group message, and you know, no spoilers, please. Like I'm not going to be around. Just don't talk about it. Talk about it amongst yourselves in a different conversation, but never ends up happening. And then something gets spoiled. So yeah, I just kind of had the phone off for a while until the Browns had made their 2 picks. So
We'll talk about the draft and some other sports in a second, but there were a couple of interesting things that I think we both discovered over time as we were getting to know each other on Twitter.
For sure.
What I mean by that is there were two things. The first one is we went to the same high school, though you are 8 years younger than me.
Yes.
And when we were first talking about it, I was referencing like the younger siblings of people who I was friends with, thinking you might know them, then realizing that those younger siblings are still probably older than you, which points to how old I am. The second thing is we grew up, we lived on the same street, though, I think probably only a year crossover.
Yeah.
And that street was Easy Street.
That's right. Yeah.
So I haven't talked to anyone about this really ever, but looking back, what was it like telling people you lived on Easy Street?
You know what? You always got that kind of reaction, and I'm sure it was the same for you when you're like, you had buddies that were coming over, and you're like, yeah, it's just Easy Street. And the real catch, and you'll obviously, and hopefully your listeners will like this as well, is that for the name Easy Street, it couldn't have been any harder because it was really not a street. It was kind of a bay. So if you were coming in the main drag into Norman Park, which was the area that Alan and I lived in, if you're coming into it, your first right-hand turn is Easy Street. If you keep going, your second right-hand turn is Easy Street. So you always had to kind of explain, I live on the second Easy or I live on the first Easy. And then it was this kind of windy, bendy road that it wasn't like a true bay or anything. Like it really kind of snaked.
It ended up becoming a bay because it kind of started and ended on the same street. But you're right. It was like there were probably in the end, what, 100 houses along the whole stretch of the road. So it stretched around and then it kind of went around a back area and then it came out where your portion of Easy Street was.
Exactly.
And then where it turned and came out, I believe it also kept going. Like it was strange.
Yeah.
It was almost like, if you went down your Easy Street, you'd come to a stop sign.
Yes.
And then and your portion of Easy Street would actually end. You couldn't go straight through it. And if you took a right, you'd still be on Easy Street.
That's right. That's exactly how it was. So, I mean, but you'd always get the reactions like, yeah, you don't really live on that street kind of thing. Or what's it like living on Easy Street? It's like, I don't know, man. It's just a house. Like it's the same as your house. You live on Redview. It's the same, like, kind of thing. But it definitely was a story kind of thing, and it was a great neighborhood to grow up on or in. A lot of my friends that I still have today grew up in that neighborhood or just around that neighborhood. Being there at the time, I moved there when I was 12 and then lived there until I finally moved out when my parents kicked me out at 22. So,
are they still there?
Yeah, my parents are still there. Okay. Yeah, my parents and one of my sisters are still there at the same house. And the house actually, funny enough, used to be owned by one of your good friends too, right?
Yeah, so, growing up, one of my good friends and who played street hockey with us all the time, and I'd go over there and play Nintendo. Yeah. Yeah, right after they moved into that place. There was quite a few of us. There was a few on that part of Easy Street. We had some friends on Redview.
Mm-hmm.
I was over on the other part of Easy Street, and then we'd play street hockey on Redview.
Yeah, Redview was really the street, and maybe to set it up for your listeners, yeah. There was kind of, when you're coming down Redview, there was the main street, but then there was also kind of like a little carve out of the street where, you know, you could park a car or whatever like that. And then it was just basically driveways right there. So a lot of times if traffic was heavy, you could just move the nets over and play in this little alcove of a street, and it was just perfect. Nobody would interrupt you. You could play for days. And it's funny because even for me growing up a couple years after Allen, it was the same thing. Like you'd get home from school. You'd quickly do your homework, grab a bite, and then it was just street hockey for the whole night. So
best part about our street hockey was we had a family that lived on the same street. They didn't have kids. There was an older couple, but they had a dog, and the dog would come out and she would chase the ball around, but she wouldn't pick it up during the action. But when we'd fire it past the net and down the road, she'd get it for us.
Oh, saves you a track.
Yeah, yeah. So that was the special part of our street hockey. The other street hockey story is in the summer we would play with rollerblades.
Oh yeah, so did we, and it never ended well.
And then a number of us we had a team that was in a roller hockey league.
Okay.
And my friend's dad, my best friend at the time's father, kind of helped manage the team. So half of the players on the team were kids around our age, 15, 16 years old. And so he brought in some other people. He ran a trucking company, so he brought in like young, like, you know, 20-year-old truckers.
Right.
And then one of the truckers who was playing with us was like, well, my brother plays hockey, and he's off for the summer and home, so he's going to come and play some games with us. And it was Lonnie Bahanas.
Oh, no way.
Who played with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and at that time was the leading scorer with the Portland Winterhawks. And my two memories of Lonnie Bahanas were... after we won a faceoff from center ice, taking a slap shot and scoring. Cause it's just, he's like a ringer, like literally in this league. And the second one is he fed me beautifully on a 2-on-1 and I fanned the, I fanned on it.
So what could have been a beautiful, Bobby Orr kind of moment for you ended up being the Dan Bylsma moment where you just fanned on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a professional hockey player set me up and couldn't make it happen. So there you go. How about CJS? I mean,
yeah.
When I graduated from CJS, it was 1996. We had, earlier in 1996, our principal, Terry Boris, was the person who introduced me to the internet. I didn't even know what the internet was. I was in the library one day with a few other people, and we were about to go to a class, and he was in there, and he's like, can I show you something? And we were like, well, we're about to go to class. And he's like, you can be late for it. And we're like, okay, cool. What do you got to show us? And then he showed us the internet. And it was like, that's the moment where we saw it. So I can't even imagine this school, like, wired for anything.
No, well, and, I mean, even, so 8 years later, graduating in 2004, it was still kind of behind in terms of technology, I guess you could say. Like, the library had one computer. The computer lab got all those, like, the colored Macs. Like, that it was just the screen. Like, there was no tower or anything, and they were all, like, pink or green or purple or blue, but they were, like, the worst computers ever in terms of any kind of bandwidth or speed or anything. So you're even logging on takes you 10 minutes on these things. But from what I remember, it was primarily a band kind of high school. Like, if you were looking to be more artsy, which I kind of was, we didn't have a theater or drama class until my senior year, and by then my electives were all used up. That's when they started deciding that they were going to introduce like theater or drama, law, a sociology class, all these classes.
And just so you know, we had theater in my,
Did you back then?
Yeah. There were theater kids. I don't think it was a very serious theater program, but I guess at some point they dropped it for a while. Yeah. We had theater.
Well, and I think it all kind of depended on the teachers, right? Like when I was there, there was a lot of, we had a lot of intern teachers or, you know, young teachers that were just kind of starting out that had also, been alumni of the school kind of thing. So that was a really cool touch, but at the same time, a lot of them were geared to either, you know, teaching French or teaching science or teaching, you know, a language class. And it wasn't, until we got a little further along into my, junior and senior years that they, kind of made the push to be like, well, let's offer these kids a little something more than what we have been kind of thing. But, the band program was always strong. I didn't really do anything extracurricularly when I was there. I just kind of showed up, went to class, went home kind of thing, hung out with my friends. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, definitely, I'm sure if you and I were to walk the halls today, a lot of memories would come back. Be it, the box, there was this big wooden box, that was kind of a lost and found, but it was, it was just a shit pile of a box. Like anything that was actually found in that box was never good anymore.
And this is like very inside stuff. I know for those of you that didn't know, but I got to ask the question.
Yeah.
The box at your time, was it located? You walk out of the cafeteria and the box
and the box
there?
Is right there. Okay. And if you, anybody who was anybody hung out on that box and
I don't know if it's the same box. I have no idea if I should check. That'd be one of the first things I check. But if it is, and you open up the lid of the box, carved into it is my friend Poops McKenzie's real name.
Oh, there you go. You know what? We have to go back then.
Yeah.
Well, and it's funny enough, Alan and I were talking kind of before the show. This is the 25th anniversary of CJS. So maybe if I can get back in the doors, I'll definitely look for that. I'll look for the vending machine that would just eat your money and never give you any kind of snack or candy. I'd make sure that the old lunch lady that would serve you the poutines is still there serving up poutines and muffins. But, I mean, in terms of an education though, it was great. It set me up. I was able to, get good enough grades there and be proficient enough in the French language that I was able to go on to, now it's Université Saint-Boniface. It was Collège Universitaire Saint-Boniface at the time. And then I got an arts degree there. I was going to go into education, but, the man called and said I needed to start paying bills as opposed to racking up debt. So, I got into the world of finance, but that's a different topic. But I do look back fondly, of my time there. And I'm sure it's probably the same for you. Like, it was never like you never felt. You go to some schools in the city and like there's a tension or an uneasiness. Like there was never that there. It was always jovial. Like it was never like the school's on lockdown because somebody's getting stabbed. Oh, the cops are here. Oh, this kid's getting busted with weed. Like that would happen in a blue moon, but it was never like a big production kind of thing. So I think from that aspect, like we were really lucky to have a normal high school life.
The two big stories during my time and when I went to CJS, what happened was they had just opened the school and there wasn't enough immersion to fill just a high school.
Right.
So CGS, when I went to it, was a 6 to 11 school, like grade 6 to grade 11, and I was in grade 6. And then when I went to grade 7, they dropped 6, and it was a 7 to 12.
Oh, and then they just...
And then when I went to 8, it was an 8 to 12, 9 to 12. So for 4 years, we were the youngest in the school. But I went to the school for a total of 6 or 7 years. And the two big events that happened while I was there that I can recall were a dog getting hit by a car in front of the school and then a person getting hit by a car in front of the school.
Oh, yeah. I had a buddy that, that probably similar story. My cousin once mooned the band bus on the way to Saskatoon and they held a grudge long enough to call back the school and make sure he got suspended. And then the other one, I had a buddy that was trying to get on a bus and it ran over his foot. And that's basically like the craziest things that happened to me in high school. So
I think when I was in grade 12, one of the kids also drove his car into the school sign in front of the school.
Oh, really?
I don't know how that happened.
But they needed to replace that sign in a bad way anyway, and I think they have since, but yeah.
They have an electronic one now. At the time, it was the one where you put, you have to put the letters and the individual letters up in the thing. So so you went to, at the time, it was CUSB, as you mentioned, and again, you switched from education to finance, so that was just out of...
That was out of necessity. Yeah. And it wasn't even like a switch in terms of schooling. It was more so me just being like, okay, here's my arts degree. I'm kind of tapped for cash. My parents had basically helped me along and paid for a lot of my education. But then it got to the point where it was like, well, do you want to take on this student debt or do you want to go out and start making money? And at that point, I did a couple of the tests and I kind of slacked off a lot when I was there. Like, it wasn't like high school anymore where you had, your teachers that are chasing you around, making sure that you're not wearing a hat, making sure that you're going to class and all that. It wasn't like that. So I never had anybody that was there, forcing me to do things. So it was in that independence that I just kind of, I took it for granted, I guess you could say.
Sounds familiar, by the way.
So, and I think it's the same for a lot of kids. Like, I know a lot of people would probably relate to this. Like you're 18, you're coming out of high school. You probably still don't know what you really want to do, but somebody's telling you that you got to go do something, in terms of education. And it's so easy to be like, well, I, you know, I don't A, want to do this at all, or B, I can't cope with now all this new independence that I'm just being given to run free with. And it's even different too, like when you're only paying a fraction of your schooling or none of your schooling in some cases, it's so easy to be like, well, I don't give a fuck, right? Yeah. Like, whatever.
And on top of that, you're going to school, but it's also like, I'm allowed to go to bars now. And
right.
You know, there's this whole new world of shit that I'm allowed to do that before, like, you still might have curfew or something, but you're like, I'm 18, I'm an adult. There's a whole new world out there for me.
For sure. So, I mean, for me, I guess what ended up happening, long story short, is that the GPA drove down far enough that I was below the threshold to get into education. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, you can take all these extra classes and, you know, if you really want it, you can do it. But by then I was like, nah, you know what? Let's just go make money. And I look back on it and kind of have mixed feelings about it. Some regret, kind of wish that I would have done things differently. But here I am now and just kind of rolling with it. So,
did you have interest in journalism at that time?
I did. It was kind of about a year after I graduated from the CUSB. I started writing for a blog. I made my own blog because I just felt like I was missing something in my life, in terms of something that I felt passionately about, something that drove me artistically. So I started off like a GeoCities or like a Blogspot blog. And, at the time I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm going to write about. Like, it's tough to just like write a blog about yourself. I have great admiration for people that can do that and, you know, tell some of their most personal stuff all the time. So I was like, well, I'll write about the Washington Capitals. Like, let's do that. So I kind of started blogging, doing that and really fell in love with it. And then kind of took a bit of a hiatus. And then this Arctic Ice Hockey position opened up in 2011. There was a call for writers, and I was like, well, why not hop back on the horse, so to speak? So did that for about 3 years, and then it just became more like work than it did pleasure, so to speak. You know, like when you're expected to pump out post after post every day kind of thing, it just kind of becomes mundane, and then you're repeating yourself, and you're not fresh. And then, you know, your stories kind of suffer for that, so to speak. So, that's when I knew it was time to kind of just let it go.
All right. Let's take a little break from the interview to go through some housekeeping items and give you some information about this show. If you want to find us on Twitter, you can look us up at Beyond the Handle is the handle for the show. So definitely give us a follow there. We are on Facebook. Do a search for Beyond the Handle and we will pop right up there for you. If you are not listening to this show via iTunes or Stitcher, you can go to each of those platforms and subscribe to the show. Again, just go in and search for Beyond the Handle. We will pop up there for you. Click on subscribe and the new episodes will download to your device every week as soon as they are posted, which is nice, easy, and convenient. Of course, if you just want to hear a stream of a specific episode, you can also go to beyondthehandle.podomatic.com and you can find the show right there and listen to any episode that you would like to hear. If you'd like to email me and give me some feedback, recommend a guest, or if you'd like to be a guest yourself, I'd love to hear from you. The email address is beyondthehandle@gmail.com. And again, any feedback via Twitter or via email is very much appreciated. We are a part of the Garbage Hill Network of podcasts. This is Winnipeg's first podcast network and features a number of local podcasts from around the city of Winnipeg. You can give them a follow at Garbage Hill on Twitter, and their website is www.garbagehillnetwork.com. So with all that being said, let's get back into the interview. This is Trevor Mon, also known as TJ Mon, also known as at TJ underscore Mon, here on Beyond the Handle.
So with Arctic Ice Hockey, which, again, for those of you that don't know, is a Sports Nation blog that follows the Winnipeg Jets specifically.
Right.
What were some of your favorite things that you posted on there? more notable?
Well, very mixed reaction, and especially like around this time right now. Like I know, I don't visit the site as much now as I had been, but I know that Kara, who writes for that blog, just wrote last week about a sexism post about the Katy Perry
yes,
chant,
I do.
And she just got roasted for it. Which is funny because I still think like I won't get into it. I mean, if we want to later, we can, but
we sure can if you want to. Yeah.
but everybody was comparing that piece to a piece that I had wrote a couple years before, where I basically said that Winnipeg had a race problem with Evander Kane because of kind of the way that he was being treated in the media by fans that were kind of purple monkey dishwashering, like, oh, my buddy's brother's cousin's sister saw him at this bar and he totally got knocked out, so that's what happened kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that was probably my favorite one ever. It had a lot of reaction, both positive and negative. So that was probably when I realized kind of the pull that I had there, and also that I needed to maybe not be so accusatory at the same time. It was kind of a learning experience. So
what was like very strong reactions on
very strong reactions? Because, well, and it's the same with the sexism piece, right? Because mm-hmm. people that are offended are allowed to be offended because that's the world that we live in. We live in a free world, and it's not up for me to tell Alan here sitting across from me what offends him. And if I said something off brand, or if I threw a bottle cap at him right now and he said, hey man, that really offended me, it's not for me to say, well, you're dumb for letting that offend you. That's his prerogative. That's the way that he lives. So I think that what it is that people are very insecure in themselves. And if they took joy in the Katy Perry chant or, you know, Evander Kane's plight, and then somebody writes like, hey, this is sexist or this is racist, then they feel kind of like they're being lumped in as a sexist or misogynist or as being racist. Mm-hmm. And that's where you get a lot of, well, let me tell you this, I'm not this and this and this. And I'm like, I never purported you to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Katy Perry chant for me didn't affect me because I'm a white male aged 18 to 50. Like, really, the world's my oyster. Mm-hmm. I can do basically anything. Because nobody's going to oppress me, right? So for people to come out and say, well, you know, you're a girl or you're transgender or you're whatever and you're stupid for being offended by this, I don't get it. But
just for, again, for those of you that don't know, the chant that we're talking about is in the Game 3, the first game that was here in Winnipeg. Very loud, great crowd, like fantastic crowd here in Winnipeg. And the MTS Center likes to come up with creative chants.
Mm-hmm.
The chant that they decided to do during that game was directed towards Corey Perry, who we were talking about earlier, and they started chanting Katy Perry at him. And Katy Perry is a very famous, I almost said talented.
Debatable on who you ask, right?
Very famous. I mean, she had a hell of a Super Bowl show.
Oh, did she ever? Yeah, with help from Missy and Left Shark. But still, no, a great Super Bowl show.
They chanted Katy Perry, and so the argument then is that the insinuation that let's chant a girl's name at the guy hockey player, and so the reaction then is that a sexist chant? And my take on it is I wasn't offended by it.
Right.
I didn't think it was... They've done way, way better chants. I didn't think it was terribly creative.
Right.
And I wasn't offended by it. But the moment that it happened, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah,
like,
somebody's going to be...
We know what's going to happen here because yeah. there are people that are going to take offense to this.
Well, and especially on Twitter, too, right? Like, it's just kind of a melting pot for ideas and for argument, right? So... as soon as that kind of happened, I was probably the same as you, just rapidly checking my phone to see what the reaction was. But I knew it was going to be mixed, and it wasn't going to be good because people were going to be upset and offended, and then people were going to be upset that people got upset about it, right? And instead of listening and talking, it's just, you know, two different groups that are just mm-hmm. opposing each other.
There are two issues that I took with it. The first one is that it's our chance to be in the national spotlight, and we've really pumped our tires, and really every media outlet's pumped our tires as being such a fantastic fan base. And again, the crowd pretty much proves it, right?
Right.
But then you walk out of there, and now you've got to have this fucking debate, mm-hmm. you know, that happens. You can't just say, and again, I get, you know, like, there are people that are allowed to be offended, right? But on both sides of the argument now, you can't just walk away in agreement saying, wow, what a kick-ass crowd there is. You have to have this debate that goes on for whatever reason. And the second one is, I mean, I'm a big fan of very rude humor.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to come to my house and crack the rudest jokes in the world, have at it. If I do it on Twitter and you don't like it, unfollow me, right?
Right.
But this is a larger forum, right? And you're trying to welcome in not just 15,000 people into the building, but a fan base.
Sure.
And I get that you're not going to sit there feeling oppressed if you're hearing that chant necessarily. But if you don't like it and if it offends you, and let's say that it's, you know, 15-20% of the fan base, that's still a large chunk, and you're trying to be as welcoming an organization
as an environment.
As possible.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, to use kind of a wrestling phase for you, because I know that you're a real wrestling fan, and going back to what you'd said, the not only local media, but mainstream media everywhere, like you said, was really pumping Winnipeg's tires and, hey, this is great, and, you know, Winnipeg's back, and it's so loud in there, and it's white, and it's bright, and, like, these fans are really awesome. And then to see kind of the heel turn on Twitter between the Katy Perry chant in Game 4 and reading guys like Myrtle and guys like Bruce Arthur in Toronto be like, well, I'm glad that they're gone now kind of thing. Like, where it was going into Game 3, like, this is awesome, congrats Winnipeg, super cool, and to being like, well, good. You know, mm-hmm. Normally I wouldn't cheer for Anaheim, but Winnipeg gave me a reason now kind of thing. So it's kind of like, well, I worry about how my city's perceived in that light, and especially from bigger cities. And I think that that's just part of being a Winnipegger, is that we're all kind of insecure about ourselves in some way, shape, or form. And that's why, you know, when somebody says, I thought that chant was racist, and you were at sexist, and you're there chanting it, or not even there chanting it, but condone that it's being chanted, then you feel like somebody's kind of indirectly calling you sexist, mm-hmm. because it's a Winnipeg insecurity thing. So
I think another thing with some insecurity here was there were a few bloggers from, I guess they work for an SB Nation site in California.
Yeah.
That really got the goat of Winnipeggers. And it's a, like, I get that everybody does great work, and I really love the work that the blogs do, and I follow them more than any other press, right?
Right.
But on the flip side, for their reaction to it, I want to be like, it's a fucking blog. Like,
exactly. And that's kind of SB Nation's dilemma that they're having right now. And anybody, the blog that Alan's referencing is Battle of California, which is basically a melting pot of all the California hockey teams. They all have their independent blogs, but Battle of California is just kind of like a spoof blog, like Alan had said, that, like, really their goal is to make, you know, foul humor. They do a lot of cartoons that are kind of done in jest, tongue-in-cheek kind of stuff. Like, that's kind of who they are. Like, they write about how each other suck. Like, often you'll read posts done by Anaheim fans about why it's terrible to live in LA. Like, that's just kind of the way the blog is, right? So a lot of times it's people reading an individual story and not having a context as to what they do. But at the same time, SB Nation wants to be, you know, the site that's really like news clicky. And it's like, hey, this woman lost 300 pounds. You'll never guess what she did. Click here kind of thing, only with sports. But they also want to be hard hitting news and do interviews. And then they also want to, you know, do jokes. So it's great that they want to do all these things, but under their current setup, it's really tough. Because if you're just, you know, an average fan that doesn't follow these blogs, you don't really know what everybody's trying to convey, right? From the standpoint of SB Nation kind of thing. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I agree with you there. Like, I look at that and I go, if SB Nation wants to actually be taken seriously and compete with some of the more serious and, you know, again, mainstream news organizations, for example, those kinds of blogs aren't likely going to lend to the credibility of the product.
Right.
Again, not that I didn't find them amusing. And again, you read them knowing the context, like, you know, the roast to Winnipeg. It's like, it's right there in the title.
Yeah.
It's a roast to Winnipeg. It's supposed to be rude and insulting.
And they do it for every team. Yeah. Like, every team that gets eliminated until you crown a champion. It's done through Yahoo Sports Puck Daddy. And what they do is they get bloggers from other blogs, in this case, Battle of California, to write these scathing roasts about other, and to be honest, I love what Jared does for Battle of California. Like, I think that he's really witty. I don't think it was his best work. Like, I think that he could have been way more you know, mean and insensitive about it, as opposed to being like, hey, it's the Thrashers and hey, Winnipeg stinks kind of thing. But yeah. I mean, that was still enough to get the feathers ruffled for more than enough Winnipeg fans, right? So all I can really say is people need to take it kind of with a grain of salt, so to speak. And it's okay to laugh at yourself sometimes. Like, it's not everything. It's sports. It's not serious business. Nobody died. They're going to be back in October, and they're going to play in front of the same crowd. The rink's going to be the same size. The puck's going to be the same size. Nothing's changed. So just relax, Winnipeg. It's okay.
All right. You are decked in orange.
I am.
Cleveland Browns orange.
It's a gift and a curse.
I guess those are still the old colors now, though, technically, right?
Technically speaking, yeah. Like, the orange will still be prominent on the helmet. They have a third jersey that's orange, but yeah, for the most part, I'm expecting to see a lot of brown and a lot of white this year.
So, why... You already live in Winnipeg and you have to be a Jets fan, right? So why do you further punish yourself?
I think that the thing about my Cleveland sports fandom is that Cleveland really reminds me a lot of Winnipeg. Like, it's Winnipeg U.S. version where, you know, the fan base is a really tightly knit community. They all are very passionate about their teams, whether they're winning or losing. And they also kind of have those same kind of insecurities with, you know, how they're perceived on a national, level and all that. But, you know, they were an expansion team in 1999. I grew up a big Vikings fan, because living out in Ile-de-Shane, my dad had jerry-rigged us, American cable, through however he made the antenna work. So there was a lot of Vikings and Timberwolves games on. And we moved to the city again in 1998, and that was the year that they went to the conference NFC conference championship game, and they were playing the Atlanta Falcons, and they were 15-1. They had a great year. Randy Moss was tearing things up. Chris Carter looked great, and they're going to kick a field goal to win the game. Gary Anderson trots out, Hall of Famer kicker, was 63-for-63 on the year, hadn't missed a field goal all year, automatic, 40 yards, gonna hit it. And they come out, you know, he parades out, and the announcer's like, and here's Gary Anderson, he's 63-for-63 this year, this is basically, you know, a chip shot for him. I'm like, he's going to miss this kick, and I'm going to be so upset. And sure enough, misses the kick. Atlanta ends up winning in overtime. They go on to get smoked by Denver for Elway's second of two Super Bowls, and then he retires.
Yep.
And I said, I'm never going to let a team hurt me like that again.
Oh, great.
So Cleveland was becoming an expansion team in 1999, and little did I know what was in store for me and how much worse they've hurt me than ever one missed kick could have. So kind of jumped on the bandwagon then. They had drafted Tim Couch, who I thought was a great blue-chip prospect of a quarterback, and he was okay. Injuries kind of put an end to his career a little earlier than most had thought. But, It's weird. I can't really explain it, kind of thing. And like every year, they give me a reason not to cheer for them, and I'm like, I'm so done with this team. Like, I'm done. I can't cheer for them anymore. And there's really nothing that ties me to them. Like, I'm not a season ticket holder. Outside of, you know, some shirts and some hats and some hoodies and a couple of jerseys, that's all I'm invested. I could walk away at any time. But you know, then camp starts up in summer, and you get into preseason, and then it's like, okay. How are you going to break my heart this year? Yeah. I'm hoping that you find a new creative way. So that's kind of the gist of it.
And so, and for, again, for those of you that aren't aware, you're referring to them as an expansion team.
Right.
Based on, now this is kind of funny because the Jets, we've got the same kind of thing with the Winnipeg Jets here, right? Mm-hmm. Where we've got, there's a lot of debate over, there was a team here in Winnipeg, they moved to Phoenix.
Right.
And the history of that team has carried on in Phoenix, according to the NHL.
Right.
The team record, Dale Hawerchuk is the leading scorer of all time for the Phoenix Coyotes.
Yeah.
The Atlanta Thrashers moved to Winnipeg. They're renamed the Winnipeg Jets. The leading scorer of all time on the Winnipeg Jets is Ilya Kovalchuk,
yeah,
who played all of the games in Atlanta. He's never played a single game here in Winnipeg.
Right.
At least for the Jets.
Correct.
Right? Now, with the Cleveland Browns left Cleveland in, I think, 96.
Yeah.
And they went to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it was set up or decided at the time was that, despite the fact that this organization uprooted and went to Baltimore, they were considered to be a first-year organization when they were in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So the franchises, I think their first ever draft pick was Ray Lewis.
Jonathan Ogden and then Ray Lewis. Okay. Yeah.
So and that's the Baltimore Ravens.
Correct. History. And at the time, they didn't even have a team name. They were just Baltimore with a NFL helmet, right? So.
And so then, in 1999, and this had been a promise, I think, that had been made that they were going to come back into Cleveland.
Yep.
And so they introduced the Cleveland Browns.
Right.
Same team, same logo, and same history. So now team records for this new expansion team are actually Cleveland Brown records from 1996 and before, and Baltimore Ravens team history. It's like the team just fell out of the sky in 1996, and 4 years later, won a Super Bowl.
Yeah, exactly. And it's even weirder, too, when you take into context that the Baltimore Colts moved to Indianapolis and now work under the guise of the Indianapolis Colts and carry all those records forward with them. So it's this big commodule of records and stats that I don't understand. Like, pick one or the other. I don't know that either one is right. I'm not going to purport, like, I don't think it's that big of a deal either, because especially in Winnipeg, these stats are going to rewrite themselves anyway. Mm-hmm. Outside of Solani's rookie goal scoring record, everything else is going to rewrite itself. So I wouldn't be too bent out of shape about it, but at least in the NHL, there's precedence, and they've kept the same precedence instead of saying, well, this team's going to have brand new stats and they're not going to carry over the stats, despite the fact that they're actually moving. They're not an expansion team. They're the Cleveland Browns that are moving. They're going to have brand new stats. And then the Cleveland Browns, when they come back in 1999, we're just going to act like they never left. So I don't get it.
Do you look upon any, like the history of the Cleveland Browns prior to 99? Like, do you, are those things you look at and you think of, like, they haven't been to a Super Bowl, right? But when they won NFL championships, do you look at, like, those and be like, yeah, those are my Browns? Or
I think that you kind of have to, just to give yourself, like, a kind of delusion that it can be better. but at the same time, like, you look back and it's a lot. Though they won more, it's still a lot of the same kind of heartache, right? Like, you had Red Right 88, you had the fumble, you had the drive, like, all these things in the late 80s that kept them from being that Super Bowl team, because they could never get out of the AFC conference. But, mm-hmm. And I think for long-standing Cleveland fans, especially ones that live there, they still look upon Bernie Kosar fondly, even though he's not good. Like, by the time Bernie was done there, he could barely spell his name because he was so concussed. But people still love him and revel in him because that's the best that they've had in 2 decades, right? So, and, you know, it's kind of the same to kind of bring it back to Winnipeg and the Jets. Like, it's so easy to love Anthony Peluso when or Chris Thorburn, when that's all you've really known, right? You don't know that your fourth line could be way better because that's all you've really known. You have nothing to compare it to. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of one of those things where you look back fondly on certain times. Like, I was a fan. I kind of followed them their last year because it was a big story, and Vinny Testaverde was their quarterback for a bit, and Belichick was actually coaching them before he went off and became the Bill Belichick we all know and love now. And it was tough watching them play that final game at Cleveland Municipal Stadium and people ripping benches out and throwing them on the field, and their center Chris Everett, like, jumping into the crowd and just being mobbed. Like, people were grabbing tape off of him just to take anything with them. Like, it was really, and it's funny because the juxtaposition was a spring later, the same thing kind of happened in Winnipeg where the Jets left. And I mean, it wasn't to the same extent that people rioted in a stadium, but, you know, the Jets Fly Forever banner comes down, they do the final lap around the ice. And even as a 12-year-old kid, it's tough not to get a little emotional about it. So, I think that's probably why Cleveland is that it just reminds me a lot of Winnipeg. I'd love to cheer for a winning team, but I just can't be like, well, now I'm going to go cheer for the Baltimore Ravens, or now I'm just going to go cheer for the Pittsburgh Steelers, because that's just not, like, I don't know. I have this masochistic thing with sports that, like, championships have to be earned even as a fan, kind of thing.
A lot of us do, right? So. A lot of us do. Why are there Leafs fans? Why, you know? That's why, you know, people give people shit for jumping on the bandwagon. Like, yeah, I could turn around tomorrow and say, who's going to win the Stanley Cup this year?
Yeah.
Caps, I'll just
go out and buy a jersey or a hat.
Caps are going to win. Here we go. Woo!
I would love that if they did. I'd have to go down.
It's a reward, right? I'd mentioned a few shows ago where it's like I've only had 3 moments in my life where the team that my heart is into has won a championship, and all 3 were Team Canada at the Olympics.
Oh yeah, there you go, hey.
Yeah, and it's like that's been it, you know. Well,
for a lot of people, that's all you'll ever get, right? Like, as much as I want to say, especially in Cleveland's circumstance, like, oh, you know, there's always next year kind of thing. Like, there are people that waited far longer than me that are now long gone that yeah. never got it. So I don't know why I think that I'm due as a fan, but I mean, I think that's the fun part about sports. No matter how good or bad your team looks, there's always optimism that this year is your year kind of thing, that things can finally fall into place, right?
Are you a Cavs fan and an Indians fan?
I am a big Indians fan. I have been, again, since probably about the mid-90s. That's when they were their best. I love Charles Nagy as a pitcher. Bartolo Colon was just coming up around that time and wasn't 400 pounds of absolute greasy mess. And they had Kenny Lofton, who was a great player, David Justice. So I fell in love with them as well. And they would always, I think the first year that I kind of watched the World Series, they were playing the Braves. And I never, for whatever reason, liked Oral Hershiser or John Smoltz or Maddox or any of those guys. So it was just became natural to cheer against them.
Yeah.
And then Cleveland went back a couple more times to the World Series, never winning.
Went to 7 games against Florida.
Yeah, and then Tony Fernandez is gloved. Yeah, I can't. It's crazy that like the random sports moments that I've remembered in my life. Like I don't know how. Like you could ask me, you know, something about my work that I did yesterday, and I'd forget it, but I remember a sporting event that took place in you know, 1997. So, but yeah, they kind of fell on hard times. They're always a team that's tough to predict, the Indians. Like this year, Sports Illustrated picked them to win the World Series. They currently have the worst record in baseball. So, right. So there you have it.
And the Cavaliers?
Cavaliers, basketball's never really been my thing, but I'll give a good shout-out here to my good friend, Cavs Anada, Justin Rowan, who I've really got to know through him writing for Arctic Ice and following the blog before that. Had the chance to hang out with him a couple times, and he's really kind of made me more of a basketball fan and to wit, more of a Cavaliers fan. So, he's been nice enough to lend me his NBA TV pass.
Yeah.
So I'll watch a game here and there. But basketball is lower on the totem pole for me as a sport.
Have you been to either Cleveland or Washington?
I haven't. I've been wanting to go to Washington for years now. I wanted to go to the Winter Classic when it was there this year. Mm-hmm. Things just didn't work out for me. I was set to go 3 years ago. I had, they were up, oh, maybe it was longer than 3 years. Like, you talk about losing track of time, like, 2000 was 15 years ago, and it's so tough to be like, oh, yeah, by the way. Yeah, 15 years have passed, but I'd say it was like 4 or 5 years ago now. They were in the playoffs. They were playing Pittsburgh. They were up 2-0 in the series. It was second round, and I'm like, I'm going to buy tickets for
the
next round.
That's Pittsburgh won the Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 2008. Yeah. So what's this now? So 7 years ago.
Yeah.
I wasn't even close. So I'm like, well, you know, they played their 2 games at home. I'm going to, you know, try to get to a conference final game. And, then it never worked out because they never made it that far, but I'm steadfast that if they do make the Cup Finals this year, I'm going. And Cleveland, I'm trying to work that out too. I have a couple of different groups that are trying to woo me with their pitches to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just kind of finding time in the fall, which is always a little tougher because you're always a little busier than you are kind of in the summer months. So
I've been to 25 NFL stadiums.
Have you?
Cleveland is not one of them.
Oh.
And they're going to cross off my list this fall.
Well, you were in Buffalo last year to see Cleveland, were you not?
I was. Cleveland wasn't playing. It was over the Thanksgiving weekend in the States.
Oh, okay.
So I got to Detroit for the Thanksgiving Thursday game, and then I drove around the lake.
Oh, yeah.
Stopping briefly in Cleveland, I snapped a picture of a Cleveland shirt for you. I remember when I was at TJ Maxx, I could have bought a... God, what player was it? Some jersey. The player that wasn't on the team anymore. That's why they're
so... Oh, yeah, just blowing it out.
I don't know who it was. And then made it all the way around to Buffalo and then saw the Bills play. And that's when Johnny Football made his debut and goes for his first drive and rushes for a touchdown and everything's hunky-dory. And then he gets creamed in the end zone the next series. And
yep.
That's... Now he's in rehab.
Well, and it's crazy, like, how fleeting that moment was where everything looked really good for about 3 minutes, And then ever since then, poor Johnny's kind of been downhill. But I mean, good for him for, I mean, I hope that he went on his own accord. I don't think that we'll ever know that for sure, whether or not they imposed that on him or he went. But, good for him for admitting that he needed that. And by all accounts, he's come out a better person. So say his teammates. So, hopefully he can find what he's looking for in life.
We've got the NFL draft on in the background. Cleveland hasn't come up to make their second round pick. I should have mentioned this is Friday, May 1st, that we're recording this.
Yes.
So second day of the NFL draft. Were you happy with the first day, draft day for Cleveland?
I was. The first round was really mixed in terms of the fan base and what people thought. They took Danny Shelton at 12, who's a big nose tackle. Cleveland ranked 32 in run defense. 32 out of 32 NFL teams last year in run defense. So they definitely needed help inside, on the defensive line. He's a big body guy that's going to command double teams and extra bodies to block him. So that should open up other players around him, if not him himself.
And he picked Goodell right up off the ground.
Yeah, that was probably like the highlight of the draft. I think I've seen it on NFL Network a good 20 times since it happened. So, I mean,
Roger Goodell's the commissioner of the NFL and, you know, pretty much basically a corporate exec. And then, when he announces the draft picks in the first round, he has these players come out and he fist bumps them and hugs them. And in this case, Shelton just picked them right up off the ground. And Shelton's what? How big is he?
He's about 370, 6'4", 6'5", 370. So yeah, he's a big dude. And it's funny because I was watching on Snapchat afterwards, they had like this snap where they kind of grouped together all this NFL draft stuff. And somebody took a snap of Roger Goodell afterwards and he's like, how is getting manhandled by Shelton? And he's like, surprisingly graceful. It looked like he was exerting some force, but apparently it was kind of like a ballerina move where he just picked him, scooped him up. But I think that he makes you better on the defensive side of the ball. And then taking Cameron Irving at 19, he's a offensive guard, so he plays on the offensive line. He's a guy that can play any position, whether it be tackle, guard, or center. So he gives you some versatility there. Neither one are sexy picks, but if Cleveland wants to improve their roster, both guys are going to be looked at to help in the trenches. So,
is there anything else you're hoping for from this draft?
I'm really hoping that they get a wide receiver at some point, hopefully here in the second round. I haven't been privy to kind of see who's been going on the screen behind us yet, but you know, if there's a guy like Jalen Strong out there from Arizona State, big wide receiver, I think that he could be helpful. In listening to the press conference that their general manager gave this morning, it kind of sounded like they went out in free agency and signed a couple older wide receivers that you know, are on the downside of their career. I guess you could say both are into their 30s, but it sounds like, you know, if their guys aren't there, they're not going to be worried about moving up to take them. They're just going to probably go with best player available. But if wide receiver's there, that'd be great. Another linebacker would never hurt, depending on who's on the board at that point. Paul Dawson from Texas Christian might be a guy that I'd like. But really just kind of rounding out your roster. Like there's holes almost everywhere except for in the defensive secondary. So if they can find a way to get guys in that are character guys that make the team better, then that's great.
Strong is still out there right now.
That is good news. Hopefully they
Houston's
they take
up it. Picking right now, and then where is Cleveland on here? Second round, right?
Yeah, they I think that
they have the 19th pick, so they're a ways away still.
Yeah, I think that they're probably in the next 7 or 8.
About 7 or 8 to go. All right, well, I guess we won't get the pick, your reaction to the pick here on the air, but...
Oh, no worries.
But go Browns.
Yeah.
Good luck in the draft.
Thank you.
I guess a couple of quick things before we wrap things up. We've gone about 50 minutes, and I can go longer, because we can talk about CJS for another hour.
Well, probably could, yeah. Regale everybody of our tales, so...
But quickly, you had mentioned music as an interest, and we've had music talk on Twitter before, but... Any genres or anything specific that you're...
Well, I mean, like you said, we have had music talk. I'm really a music fan that doesn't really have boundaries. Like, I can listen to almost anything. I'm more, like, musically... more so the music gets to me than the vocals a lot of times. Matthew Good, I think, is probably my favorite artist. I know that he's one of your favorite.
Yeah, and you're going to endear yourself to Poops McKenzie, too. It's his favorite.
There you go, perfect. I mean,
the Matthew Good song was his wedding song.
But, I mean, like, I could really listen to a radio station that's entirely dedicated to his catalog and the Matthew Good band, and I'd be fine with that. Like, I know you and I have both expressed our distaste for local radio stations and what they have to offer. You know,
and it's been a topic on this show by a few people too.
Well, I know Ryan had. Whoops, I'm breaking not things. I know Ryan had talked about it too previously, and you know, it's one of those things where either if it's like a local alternative rock station, you're either going to have AC/DC, Van Halen, like the Sammy Hagar kind of screamy music, or you're going to have the bands that sound like Soundgarden or Default or Theory of a Dead Man that all have that like grumbly voice kind of thing. Like nothing's different kind of thing. So and then you have like your pop stations, right? So really, as somebody that likes a lot of indie, like underground hip hop, you know, anything, I find myself using XM radio a lot more. Just because most everything on the radio is just commercial anyway, or you know, getting news or weather updates, and then some shitty Eagles 1 hour block where they just play Hotel California on loop. So,
I had someone on that did a couple of shows ago who might disagree with you on the Eagles part.
Oh, really?
Fantastic. Yeah, his name is Steve on Paris.
Right.
Check out his. Everyone should check out his YouTube page because. The Eagles, I'm not a huge Eagles fan, but the Hotel California solo that he plays is
on point.
Prime stuff. Yeah, it's really, really good.
It's funny, like the only times, and sorry for going long, but the only times that I really listen to the radio nowadays is when I'm trying to hit the post on songs, like songs that have long intros, and I'm trying to like talk up until the part that the voice comes in.
Yeah.
So I make up all these wacky like radio stations that I'm on and stuff like that. But yeah, a lot of it's, you know, the same stuff that you listen to. Like, I could go and teleport back to 2002 when I was in high school and driving my 1989 Toyota Corolla at 10 a.m. in the morning and then come back to today, present day, at that same time, and they're going to be playing Bob Cajun by the Tragically Hip. So,
yeah, which was fine at the time, but now...
Yeah, it's a little worn, right?
Yeah, I'm totally with you there. There was one cause that I think you'd mentioned that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, JDRF, which is Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. My sister-in-law has type 1 diabetes, has had that since she was about 13, 14 years old, along with Crohn's and colitis. And every year I ride for her in the JDRF Ride for a Cure Challenge. It's a disease that doesn't really get a lot of mainstream play, and not on the same par as like your cancers or your Parkinson's or anything like that, but it's still, a really debilitating disease. And when not properly cared for, like she's, had bladder infections that turned to kidney infections. She's been in the ICU countless amounts of times. So it's something that I feel very passionately about. So yeah, if you guys feel like going and checking out, the website's jdrf.ca. There's a donate button, I think in the upper right-hand corner where you could just read up about kind of, type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And, that'd be really cool.
I'll put that on the notes for the show as well so people can, look there to check it out.
Awesome.
And also, again, everybody should check out TJ Maughan, M-A-U-G-H-A-N.
Correct.
So thank you very much for coming on the show. I don't know if we're actually going to do this, but when we're talking about the high school stuff, I think I can find about 5 different generations of people that went to CGS, so we may have a reunion later this year.
Yeah,
see what we can swing.
Let's do that. If you're out there, Poops and others, let's collaborate and talk about our great times eating poutines on the Lost and Found box.
Sounds great. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
So there you have it. That was Trevor Maughan, also known as TJ Maughan, and on Twitter you can find them at TJ_MAUGHAN. And as you could probably tell, I was the most excited during that interview when he made reference to the dear old Lost and Found box at Collège Jean Sauvet. Just a magical place during my youth and during his youth. So there you have it. If you want to get some more information on juvenile diabetes research, head over to www.jdrf.ca. There is a lot of information on the site. There's a donate button for you to donate to the cause, and there is information on a number of events such as the Tell Us Walk to Cure Diabetes or the JDRF Ride for Diabetes Research. Definitely go and check it out. The music for today's show is a band from Los Angeles, California. One of my favorites. They are called Tijuana Panthers, and the track is one of my favorites by them. It's called Crew Cut. You can find the Tijuana Panthers over at Bandcamp, and the album is called Max Baker. So definitely go and give them a listen, and we will play the song to close the show. So thank you very much again to everybody for listening. Thank you to Trevor for coming on to the show, and we will see you all again in a week.